Okay, our first speaker for session two is Alex Horner Devine, assistant professor for the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. And he's here to give a talk titled Plume Soup, How a Dash of River Water Affects Washington's Coastal Ecosystem. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Can everyone hear me on the mics? Is it too loud? Okay, I'll whisper to myself. I feel like some kind of wiretapping experiment. So what I'll hope to convince you of today is that river discharge, as you can see in this satellite image, coming into the Oregon-Washington coast, can have a significant impact on coastal waters, coastal productivity, and fisheries, despite the fact that it's only a dash of water compared to the total volume of the coast. And I'll define dash a little bit better in a couple of slides. So what I'll describe to you is work that I'll start actually with the motivation and show you that there is a signal, that there appears to be strong association with high fish counts up in plume waters. And then I'll try and explain that in terms of some laboratory experiments and then go back into the field to compare what we've seen in the lab to the field and suggest mechanisms that lead to intensification of biological productivity and cascades up the trophic levels to the rest of the ecosystem. So I'll start with a paradox, and that is that primary biological productivity along the Washington-Oregon shelf has long been associated with the strength of the coastal upwelling. So in a large-scale system like this, when winds blow from the north, they drive flow offshore and flow from down deep that's full of nutrients is drawn up along the coast and replenishes that near coastal water. In the presence, when it gets closer to the sun, to the surface levels and exposed to the sun, this leads to higher primary productivity. However, along the Washington-Oregon shelf, the strength of the upwelling currents due to the winds is actually stronger along the Oregon shelf than it is along the Washington shelf. So this hypothesis that I've just presented would lead you to believe that productivity should follow that. It should consistently be stronger to the south on the Oregon shelf than it is on the north on the Washington shelf. However, our observations contradict this. Productivity appears to be stronger to the north than it is to the south. And I've given the answer away a little bit in this slide, but I'm going to fill that in over the course of the talk. This paradox led to a large interdisciplinary study called RISE that's run with about 11 or 12 different PIs from many different institutions and run out of the Department of Oceanography here at the University of Washington with the lead PI, Barbara Hickey. And it focused on this question. So just to give you a little bit of a background and convince you that what I've asserted is true, this is 7 years of studies all taken in June, where people have gone out and measured surface chlorophyll in the coastal waters off of the Oregon-Washington shelf. And you can see here that although they're distributed north to south, it's generally higher along the Washington shelf than it is along the Oregon shelf. And this is even more clearer during September than it is in the June data. This is actually just showing some more of the transects that they did. And in addition to measuring the surface chlorophyll, they did fish trawls and measured juvenile salmonids, and in addition to zooplankton and hydrography. And these show their results, synthesize their results here. These different circles for different years and corresponding to different classifications of juvenile fish show the center of mass based on their data of where these fish occur. And so you see here that certainly in June and also in September, although it's a little less distinct, the fish are also clustered up along the Washington shelf as opposed to being distributed more uniformly along both shelves. So this, the effect, not surprisingly, of the primary productivity appears to move, or the abundance of chlorophyll appears to move up the trophic levels all the way up to the salmon. So we're interested in knowing why this is. And as I've suggested, a little bit in this figure. If you recognize this as the mouth of the Columbia River, and then you follow this red high chlorophyll band, the hypothesis of this RISE project was that the Columbia River, which moves preferentially to the north, is responsible for generating high chlorophyll biomass and therefore abundance and higher trophic levels north of the Columbia River along the Washington Shelf. And obviously, if this is affecting salmon abundance, this is something that's important to all of us, in addition just to greater ecosystem health. But what I'll try and convince you of is that this is somewhat of a surprising result. If you go through the estimates, the average discharge of the Columbia is about 7,000 meters cubed per day, and I estimated roughly the shelf waters out to about the 500-meter depth to have a total volume of something like 4 times 10 to the 12th, which, if you run the numbers, gives you a daily discharge from the river of about 0.02% of the shelf volume. So if you fill up your bathtub, this is equivalent to every day going up with a shot glass of water and dumping it in the bathtub. This is a minute amount of fluid that we're adding to the shelf waters, and yet it appears to have a dramatic effect on the ecosystem. So why is this? In order to answer that, I'm going to go back to a little bit of the mechanisms that describe how these plumes are formed and what they look like. To begin with, river water's fresh. Ocean water is salty. So there's a density difference. The river water floats on top of the salty water. And in fact, even in hundreds of meters of water, the river water's plume is contained typically within the top 10 meters of the water column. So that gives us a huge leg up. It's being held up in the photic zone in the upper water column. The second effect is a little more subtle, and that's that the Earth's rotation in the northern hemisphere causes flow to be turned to the right, preferentially. So that river water coming out is deflected to the right, and then it's forced, it's guided along the coast by the Earth's rotation. And this is an effect that's been known for a long time, since the 1800s when it was first described by Gustav Coriolis, and has been revisited more recently in the popular press by Bart Simpson and his renowned toilet bowl experiments, which I can discuss with anyone later because they are wrong. But to prove to you that this is true, here are three different river plumes on three different U.S. coasts. This is the Eel River plume in Northern California, and you see that the river water is coming in and carrying all sorts of sediment north to the coast, north up the coast to the right. On the Gulf Coast, the Mississippi River plume also turns to the right and follows along the coast here, in this case causing massive eutrophication and this dead zone, which is outlined in red. This is in the Gulf of Maine. We see that the Kennebec and Androscoggin rivers generate a Gulf of Maine plume that also tracks to the right as it comes out down along the coast. So this isn't really new information, but we've now described a picture of the river plume, which is contained in the top 10 meters of the water column and within 5 to 10 kilometers, typically, of the coast. And so we've taken this small amount of fluid and concentrated it along this margin, generating an ability to impact the coastal waters to a higher degree. This, however, has been known for a long time. And what I'll present to you next are some lab experiments that show that this simplified version of what happens isn't all of the isn't the whole story, and that in fact the difference can even further augment the effect that the plume has on coastal waters. So if we want to test, we've said that they're dependent on rotation, we've said that they're dependent on this density difference. So to test just those simple things, we did a bunch of experiments, and this is a rotating table that's down in the Harris Hydraulics Lab down by the canal. So we did a series of tests to look at the fundamental physics that set up how these plumes flow. This is a picture from above. We built a wall. This is the Oregon-Washington coast, if you will. And then we discharge the Columbia River in and look from above at the velocity and density fields and how those evolve. And what we see is that instead of just tracking straight down along the coast, the river water overshoots due to its momentum. It recirculates, and then some splits along the coast while some returns back to form this big eddy. And if we look straight across the eddy, we see that this has this linear profile, and I'll bring this up again later, in this recirculation. And just to confirm that the density difference makes sense too, this is a 20 centimeter deep tank, and the plume is really limited to the top couple centimeters. So this is a shallow plume that's being held to the side with this big eddy right near the river mouth. So what's the significance of this eddy? Well, if we look downstream in our laboratory plume and measure how much fresh water is actually being discharged away from the river mouth, which is here, over time, we see that the freshwater discharge is only about half of what we're putting in, of the river water, which means that half of the river water is actually accumulating in this eddy, which has been referred to as the bulge. So the bulge is growing in time and accumulating some fraction, about 50% of the river water. Now, this is work that we've done in the lab, and there's been, over the last decade, a fair amount of differing opinions between those who've been observing field plumes for a long time and those who've been modeling them in the lab and numerically. The numerical and laboratory models show this large eddy to be a really important feature, but it's been hard to pin down in the field due to the large scale and the short time scales over which plumes typically vary. So as part of this large project, the RISE project that I described before, we had an opportunity to sample the plume on scales, temporal and spatial scales, where these theories could be tested. This just shows a boat track from one of our four cruises that we did off the Washington and Oregon coast. For each of these cruises, there were two vessels, the Point Sur and the Wacoma. The Point Sur is shown here, simultaneously making measurements of hydrographic, fluid dynamical, and biological and geochemical measurements from many different platforms. For the purposes of this talk, I'll describe briefly some measurements made with the triaxis. This is just like a kite that we towed behind our boat that has all sorts of measurements on it, but the ones I'm interested in now are salinity. You see here this light blue is the plume water that's really limited to the upper 5 to 10 meters of the water column. And what we saw when we sampled north-south across the plume, so this is the Columbia River water coming out, and this is the region that, at least I, from a laboratory perspective, would have expected to see this recirculating plume. And this is a transect of salinity, and you see that when we cut across this, so this is depth now, and the colors correspond with blue being the fresher water, the plume water, you see that we get this sort of parabolic-shaped bowl of fresh water sitting out there off the coast, and that if we look at the velocities, this blue corresponds to flow here that's moving away from the coast, and then on the other end, the red corresponds to returning flow. So this is consistent with the mechanism of this big eddy that we described in the lab. And indeed, if we average over about a day, all of our transects across there, they look fantastically similar to what we see on much smaller scales in the lab. So this is centimeters per second distributed over about 20 centimeters, and here we see a half a meter per second, but over something like a 40-kilometer expanse. So this was pretty exciting for me, and it led us to wonder whether this accumulation of fluid that's observed in the lab would also be observed in this system. So the picture that I'm painting then is that there's this recirculating flow here, and you probably can't see this from the back, but that gives me more of an ability to describe to you what this looks like. This is a SAR image of the plume, and you see these very circular boundaries to the plume here. This is a MODIS image also showing the circular structure in this bulge region of the plume. And to an engineer, that sort of circularity and a nice slice through it immediately leads one to a triple integral, just so that you can say that you saw a triple integral today. So if I take my salinity profile and I integrate it in this circle, I can estimate how much fresh water is in that bowl of fluid that's revolving out there off the coast. And when I do that, I calculate that there's something like 4 to 8 days worth of river discharge sitting in this bulge offshore. So we have some feature that's setting up high retention times of water that's been recently put into the system straight from the river. So what happens to the biological system then? This is from a day and a half of transects across the plume, and I'm just plotting salinity on the x-axis and chlorophyll on the y-axis. And what we see is, for very high salinities, which are the ocean water, we get sort of low chlorophyll values relative to the mean. For very low salinities, which is the water that's just come in from the estuary, the chlorophyll values are slightly higher, but still not the highest. And it's these intermediate values that are in that bulge that I described to you where the chlorophyll values peak. So there's something magical in what comes in from the river via nutrients and what's drawn up, and what's drawn up from the coastal upwelling system. It's the combination of these two, along with this longer retention time that allows for higher productivity. So that the plume water is higher than either the river or the ocean. It's the mix that's important. So just to show this in a bit more detail, we went back and asked the geochemists if they saw similar effects in their data. And this is sort of a complicated plot, but all you need to know for now is that if things were mixing in a conservative or an expected manner, you'd get a distribution here in nitrate between the river water coming in here and the ocean water on this side. So this line's what's expected. But in days where we see the formation of this bulge, the data drops off in that region, in that intermediate salinity region. We see a huge drawdown in the nitrate, which is consistent with this longer residence time. And in fact, the same thing is observed for silicate and for iron. If you sample the primary productivity and the chlorophyll abundance, and you compare times when this bulge was observed to times when it wasn't observed, you see them shown here. So the primary productivity here is at least twice as high on days when we saw this large retentive feature than on days when we didn't. And the same sort of trend is observed in the chlorophyll concentrations that are observed outside of this region and inside. So we see that this large retentive feature, in addition to the mix of nutrients coming from the ocean and coming from the water, provides, amps up the primary productivity. The people who have done this chlorophyll research refer to it as a coastal incubator. Does this cascade up? Our preliminary evidence suggests that it does. So the zooplankton who are eating the chlorophyll, phytoplankton, also show a similar trend. And this is also a little bit hard to interpret. But what you're seeing is, in non-bulge conditions, for these salinity levels, compared to bulge conditions, there's a significant increase when this retentive feature is present relative to when it isn't. So in summary, what we've shown is that these plumes use a mixture of the upwelling-derived nutrients with the river nutrients. They mix them together and then sit them in what I've shown is this recirculating coastal incubator, if you will. And that in the presence of that, we see long residence times where this mix can sit up in the photic zone. And that significantly enhances the rates of primary productivity compared with non-bulge conditions or other coastal waters. And this primary productivity appears to move up the food chain, send a signal up the food chain, and result in amplification of these effects through the coastal ecosystem. Thanks. Yeah.
Did you see any effect on the levels of primary productivity when you had large amounts of sediment as opposed to flooding events or the dams prevent that?
So the question is, what's the effect of sediment concentration on this picture? And actually, a lot of the work that we have been doing is focused on the sediment. But we haven't tried to look at the effect of the sediment concentration on the primary productivity yet. These numbers include averages over big expanses, and the sediment concentration varies a fair amount over those expanses. What I can say is that the sediment concentration outside of the really big flooding events isn't extraordinarily high in the plume. It's something. It's less than 10 milligrams per liter of sediment. But as we move further in our analysis of these data, that's definitely something that we'll look into, is the shading effect that you get from sediment during high discharge events. And I should say it's a good question, because you would predict that you'd see this recirculation more during the high discharge events, so that there'd be a correlation between high sediment input and longer retention times. So these would tend to counteract each other. Yeah.
Do you have any insights on how the flooding river dams have affected this whole plume dynamic?
So the question is, how have the dams affected the plume dynamic and productivity? We haven't extended this work to relate them directly to the dams yet, although I have colleagues who are working on hindcasting to pre-dam conditions to see how the dynamics of the plume may be different. Certainly the retention of sediment in the dams and the decrease of sediment out into the plume is expected to be a large effect. Perhaps the other big effect would be in the mediation of the flattening of the discharge curve. The laboratory model experiments suggest that whether or not this retention feature occurs depends very strongly on the discharge. So if you had a very peaked discharge, you would have periods where this occurred, followed by periods where it didn't. If it's flattened out, which is what occurs when you put the dams in, then you're going to end up in a more intermediate regime for a longer period of time.